Telemetry News Now.
Welcome to another episode of Telemetry News Now. Today is March 12th that we're recording, so you're likely listening on the 13th, maybe the 14th, and spring has sprung here in upstate New York. Actually, I say that a little bit too soon. Spring sprang yesterday. It was 72 degrees here in the capital region of New York, and it is 42 degrees today. At least that's what the expected high is. Justin, I don't know what it's like by you. But, you know, we have about another week till spring starts, which means where I am, we have about another 6 weeks of winter.
Yeah, we're in that period of the year where you're wearing a sweatshirt in the morning and you're stripping it off because you're sweating by the afternoon, right? The pollen is in the air for sure. So,
oh, we're not quite there yet, but we will be soon. And I'm looking forward to it. So let's dive into today's headlines, starting off with something out of CNN from a couple weeks ago, but I did find it interesting. Skype is shutting down after two decades. So the news here is that maybe it's no surprise to some of our listeners, but Microsoft is shutting down Skype, which I'm sure you remember was one of the most dominant internet-based phone and video services. And if you you remember that iconic ringtone, Justin?
Oh, yes, of course. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So Skype will no longer be available starting this May 2025, and current users will be able to log in to Microsoft Teams, their free tier, using their Skype credentials. Now, Microsoft acquired Skype back in 2011 for $8.5 billion. Now, at the time, that was its biggest acquisition, so there were a lot of high hopes for Skype, obviously, right? And then what they did was they integrated Skype into several of their products, like Office and then the now-defunct Windows Phone, right? But it really never took off. Except for during the pandemic 5 years ago, there was a resurgence when they saw an uptick in usage. I personally remember Skype, and I remember how they kind of led the industry in that, you know, the beginnings of that collaboration technology over the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And when they came out, international calling was still very expensive. You know, that was still a thing that people had to deal with. So Skype made sense at the time, but I think those days are gone. And honestly, I don't see how they were ever going to compete with other solutions like Zoom or my kids use WhatsApp and FaceTime, and they're almost seamless, integrated into their devices. So, I mean, how they were going to compete without changing the product significantly, at least, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, definitely an end of an era. I remember I was in a long-distance relationship at one point in my life, and Skype was how we communicated and kept in touch, right? Because back in the days when cell phone minutes, you paid per minute, right? Skype, you didn't pay per minute. So even if it wasn't an international call, it made it really easy to keep in contact with somebody at a really low cost. So, you know, sad to see it go personally, but I get the business decision. There's all kinds of other collaboration tools that compete with it, and so it is kind of hard for it to keep up. You know, it does have significant overlap with Teams, and, you know, they mentioned if you have a free tier Teams login, you can continue to use that, which is basically the Skype functionality. So pour one out for Skype.
Next, out of the TSMC Press Center, that's the Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, TSMC has announced an additional $100 billion investment in advanced semiconductor manufacturing in the United States, bringing their total U.S. investment to $165 billion. Now, the expansion that we're talking about here builds on its existing $65 billion investment in Phoenix, Arizona, and so now this includes plans for three new fabs or fabrication plants, right? Two advanced packaging facilities and a major R&D center. So this is going to make it one of the largest single foreign direct investments in U.S. history. This is a big deal. The entire initiative is expected to generate hundreds of billions of dollars in semiconductor value for AI, of course, and presumably other technologies, right? And according to TSMC, it will support about 40,000 construction jobs over the next 4 years for this initiative, and create tens of thousands of high-paying, high-tech jobs. Now, as far as direct economic impact, they're projecting to drive over $200 billion of direct benefit to the economy across the U.S. over the next decade. And the TSMC chairman and CEO, Dr. C.C. Wei, credited the expansion to strong customer partnerships, government support, and the success of TSMC's first Arizona fab, which began volume production late last year. So obviously this strengthens the U.S. semiconductor ecosystem, right? It completes this whole agenda for, you know, strengthening the domestic AI supply chain, you know, in spite of TSMC not being an American company. And now with, you know, TSMC's first advanced packaging investments here in the U.S. itself.
Yeah. And I mean, I think when the Trump administration announced the $200 billion they were going to invest in Stargate, or I guess was it $500 billion they were going to invest in Stargate?
500, yeah.
Yeah, I expected to see more articles like this, right? Foreign companies coming in wanting to build manufacturing plants, in this case, fabrication of silicon chips on U.S. soil to benefit from some of that money. So, yeah, it's interesting to see how this is being done. Looks like they're going to be building plants in Phoenix, Arizona, Camas, Washington. I'm not familiar with that. I'm presuming that's somewhere outside of the greater Seattle area. And then Austin, Texas, and San Jose, California, right? Silicon yeah. Valley, of course.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, the only thing that I have here, I don't have incredible insight into this one, other than to say that my experience with fabs and chip fabs here where I live, and there are several, is that it's going to take a decade or more to build the thing anyway. So the direct impact is in construction jobs, which they called out, the 40,000 construction jobs. But the long-term economic impact, we're not going to see that. And it's not even going to begin to really take any kind of meaningful effect for a decade. I mean, we're talking about fabs here and not, you know, building a local retail store, whatever, you know, on the side of the road. So the greatest impact that we're going to see in half a generation, if a generation is 25 years, is just the building of these things and then all the economic impact that it has to the local areas there as a result. And that's great. That's fine. But we're not going to see this huge influx of benefit to the AI space and the tech space and just to the silicon space in general for some time. So as a follow-up from Reuters just this morning, that's March 12, TSMC also proposed a joint venture with major U.S. chip designers, that's including NVIDIA, AMD, Broadcom, and Qualcomm. Why? To operate Intel's foundry division, though it wouldn't own more than a 50% stake when all is said and done. Now, this whole thing is in the early stages of discussion, and it follows a request from the Trump administration for TSMC to help revive Intel. And I don't know, Justin, if you've seen in the news recently, Intel's been struggling with financial losses and a declining stock value. So according to Reuters, Intel's board supports negotiations with TSMC, but some of Intel's executives oppose the deal. And the reasons that they're citing are the company's differing manufacturing processes and also the protection of trade secrets. And I think that's understandable. I understand that. Now, as far as timing, this joint venture pitch was made before TSMC announced its $100 billion U.S. expansion that we spoke of, you know, just a couple minutes ago. And so, you know, while this is in discussion, NVIDIA, Broadcom and AMD are actually testing Intel's 18A chip manufacturing technology, which Intel claims is superior to TSMC's 2-nanometer process.
Yeah, so I think it's important to remember that most of the companies involved in this joint venture design the chips. So NVIDIA, AMD, Broadcom, what they do, they're what they call a fabless company. So they will actually design the chips. They have engineers that figure out what the specs need to look like, design those chips. And then they'll contract with a company like TSMC, who's the biggest company that I'm aware of in the world that does this, to actually fabricate the chips, to actually manufacture the chips, right? Intel has historically taken a different strategy with their business where they do both. They have engineers that design the chips, and then they have engineers that actually build them. They have their own foundries where they build their own chips. So the theory here is that TSMC and these other design companies want to build a joint venture to help Intel migrate from their current business strategy to one similar to the other companies where they only do their design and they outsource their manufacturing mm-hmm. to TSMC. The theory here, whether it's true or not, theory here is that that will help Intel with some of their struggles, right? It simplifies their business model. They don't have to do both sides of that equation. They don't have to do both the design and the manufacturing because like we just said in the last article, it's time consuming to build a fabrication plant. It's also time consuming to retool it. Like when you come out with a new chip design and each chip design has different nanometer technology, it's more efficient as far as the number of transistors that are on a chip and so forth. You have to retool your entire factory to be able to manufacture that new chip, right? So that's expensive and time consuming for somebody like Intel to do internally, whereas the other companies, NVIDIA, AMD, Qualcomm, Broadcom, they can all just come up with a new design, and all of the retooling cost and struggle is all TSMC's problem. Presumably that's the strategy here, is to help Intel be able to only have to do the design and outsource a lot of that expense and struggle to another company.
Yeah. You know what? Completely separate, but what boggles my mind is, not that long ago, like 12 years ago, I ran network engineering for a research organization where I am, and which was tightly integrated with some of the local fabs and some of the global initiatives. You know, they were talking about 450 nanometer and then 300 nanometer. And when I left, there was, work towards, I don't know. It just boggles my mind that we're talking about smaller sizes, like, 3 and 2 nanometer technologies here. It's crazy.
Moore's law, right?
Guess so.
Yeah. Got to keep up.
You know, what's also interesting to me is it's not interesting. I think it goes without saying at this point, considering where we are in the industry, where we are in technology and globally, is how these companies all have to work together in order to advance their own interests and advance the state of technology, which leads right into our next article right out of the Cisco newsroom. Geo Platforms Limited will be collaborating with AMD, Cisco, and Nokia to develop an open telecom AI platform, which they unveiled at Mobile World Congress 2025. So the idea here is to integrate AI-driven solutions into telecom operations. And according to the announcement, therefore enhance things like efficiency, security, revenue opportunities. And they're specifically talking about service providers. Interesting stuff. So this would create a type of like a central intelligence layer that incorporates AI and automation across all network domains, including things like the RAN, the radio access network, routing, security, data centers, things like that. And when I said AI, the first thing you thought of maybe out there is large language models and the large language model revolution that we've been going through. So the platform will be LLM agnostic and, of course, leveraging open APIs, not open API, the company, open API separate, right? Agentic AI, LLMs, small language models as well, and also other machine learning techniques, which we do need to include in a discussion about AI if we're going to be honest, because LLMs is one corner of it. And so all of that with the goal of enabling real-time intelligence and autonomous network management. And I think we're going to see more and more of this in our space, Justin, in the networking world, whether it's on the telecom side, on the enterprise side. Folks have been using these technologies like predictive analysis and classical AI and the application of ML models and all these things, and now large language models, to mine information out of data, to understand patterns, to do all that stuff for years and years in healthcare, in aerospace. And that's kind of normal for many industries now. And I feel like it's only in the last, chunk of years, 5 years, 8 years, that we're really talking seriously about applying it to IT operations and to the network.
Yeah. First of all, Mobile World Congress, if folks aren't familiar with, is an annual conference that takes place in Barcelona. It's one of the largest IT events that takes place every year, and all the mobile operators will release new technology around the mobile network, as well as new cell phones, new technology around cell phones and so forth. So it just took place last week in Barcelona. A lot of interesting articles that came out of that. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting that I think historically most companies have seen how they apply AI as a little bit of their strategic advantage, right? If they can figure out a method that others haven't figured out, that gives them a little bit of a leg up against their competitors. And we're starting to see a change in that way of thinking, it looks like, to where companies are wanting to collaborate and realizing, like, if we can all solve some of these problems in the same way and build a little bit of an alliance and share some of the research, share some of the knowledge and how we solve some of these problems, it's going to be better for the industry as a whole, instead of trying to keep it private to ourselves and try and view it as a strategic advantage to our organization. So yeah, I think it'll be interesting to see how much more quickly that helps with, development of the models, or even just how to take those models and apply them to various different use cases that apply to different areas of networking, which, kind of leads us into the next article from ARM Newsroom, another article coming out of Mobile World Congress last week, talking about AI RAN, which is basically similar to the Open Telecom AI platform that we talked about in the last article. You know, there's a lot of complexity in these RANs and the radio access networks where your cell phone is connecting to the tower. Everything from knowing if you've got a radio that's going bad, you're starting to have a lot of loss, customers' cell phone signals are being dropped. I'm sure all of us can sympathize with all of a sudden your call just drops, even though you have a good signal or you should have a good signal, but you can't get one. You know, that's still a challenge that a lot of mobile subscribers deal with. And, you know, it could be really complex, especially at scale. If you think of, you know, a huge mobile operator like, you know, we have here in the U.S. that has millions of subscribers, finding one radio that's bad until customers start complaining can be a bit of a daunting challenge. But there's a lot of data that comes out of these RANs, but how do you, you can't just have staff sitting there watching all of those stats, trying to find the signal from the noise in what's actually a problem. But that's what AI is really good at, right? Being able to correlate data, being able to sniff out from various different pieces of data what's actually a problem that someone needs to get involved in and take a look at and fix things. So the idea here is to build an alliance across multiple mobile operators to be able to build those use cases that are repeatable across companies like AT&T and Verizon in the US and, of course, other mobile operators globally.
Yeah. And the issues around power management, too, when we're talking about individual devices, you know, there's a lot of data that is necessary to do that analysis that you mentioned that is either on the device itself, it's in the provider network, it's in intermediary networks in between service providers. So I think that as we start to apply, you know, AI technologies to the telecom space, to enterprise network, all of it, you're going to see a need for more partnerships. We're already seeing a lot of partnerships. We just talked about Cisco and Nokia partnering. Like that, don't they both like make a lot of the same stuff, you know? So, you know, we're going to see more and more of that, because if you want to have an effective AI solution, you want your AI initiative to succeed and for the results to be meaningful. So you're not doing AI for the sake of AI, right? So you can get your next round of VC money, but you're actually trying to get a result. Data is the lifeblood of that. And the more data, the cleaner the data, the more accurate the data, all of that, that's what's going to empower that. Which is why I say that if your goal is to just have an AI initiative and you're going down that, like, you know, headstrong and you haven't figured out your data situation yet, it's going to fail. You know, what I'm looking at this, and yeah, you know, I hear what you said, Justin, about the specifics regarding wireless technology and then how that interplays with individual devices that the providers don't own, yet they want their data and they still have to manage power and all that kind of stuff. There's a lot of client-driven stuff there with regard to with 5G and things like that. It's going to be all about those partnerships for sure. You know, we're going to keep hearing like NVIDIA partnering with so-and-so and in order to make it happen. And rightly so.
Well, keep in mind in 5G, presumably you have a lot more radios, a lot more access points. They're doing what they call microcells, where you'll have, you know, a lot more radios that cover less devices per radio, right? So this is going to become even more important with 5G architectures to be able to find where you've got issues that are affecting your subscribers.
Yeah, for sure. And then also think about the kind of reverse CDN thing that people are talking about. I talked to somebody, I think they were at Equinix, and they were talking about this thing that they're sort of seeing and preparing for is all of the data that wearables and your devices and stuff at your house and in your business, right, is sending back to the various SaaS platforms that we use, you know, even on a consumer basis. So they can do like the cool AI stuff and then, you know, give us the meaningful results, blah, 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 which presupposes that there is this reverse CDN where like, how do I, you know, all the information from the streaming services and then we put them into POPs and then we send them out, blah, blah, blah. Well, imagine that in reverse, and 5G is going to be a big part of that. And it's for the purposes of fueling a lot of this, you know, data analysis that happens somewhere else. Although we haven't talked about edge computing and how some of that's even happening locally, regionally, and even at the device level. So we're going to see more of that as well. So really interesting stuff.
Yeah, that'll be fascinating to keep an eye on, because a lot of those networks were designed for one direction, right? From the content creator and content owner out towards the people consuming that content on their mobile device at their homes or whatever, right? So the networks weren't really designed for large volumes of traffic going in the opposite direction, right? Telemetry data coming from the edge of the network back towards you know, the content provider. So this reverse CDN idea is going to be really interesting to keep an eye on. All right, moving right along. The next article is from Infosys. This one's a little bit dated from the end of January, but it was a really fascinating kind of to what we've been talking about how AI can transform telecommunications. A couple things I took away from this one that we haven't already talked about is being able to collect all the data about subscriber behavior. This is a little bit frightening from a Big Brother perspective, but being able to analyze a lot of that data, pull out customer trends and do better targeted marketing, being able to find patterns in customer preferences, customer behaviors that allow companies to be more effective in their marketing and sales strategies, improve their customer acquisition, their customer retention. I think we all know you go and you browse for something in your browser, there's cookies that are tracking your behavior and you're getting targeted ads, right? Like that's been a thing for quite a while, but being able to like pull back your mobile behavior and where you roam, where you go and be able to use that for targeted ads. I don't know, Phil, how you feel about that. That starts to get a little creepy to me.
Yeah, it's creepy, but this is stuff that's been going on for a long time specifically. And I'm not talking about targeted ads. We already know about that. And, you know, the behavior analysis thing that social media does and that kind of thing. But I mean, with regard to the application of like ingesting data so that you can build a model and then apply it to new data, make some sort of prediction about churn or about whether a customer or prospect will buy or cancel their subscription, you know, regarding marketing stuff, right? Or business decisions. That's common. And it's been going on. And it's difficult. It's not difficult in theory. It's simple in theory, but it's difficult to do because of problems like misclassification. And I think that a lot of folks, this happens in politics a lot, like where you assign a candidate, you know, some like data scientist or quants, you know what I mean? They'll assign a candidate like 70% likelihood of victory. And everybody's like, oh, well, they're going to win. And I'm like, no, that's a 7 out of 10 chance. A 3 out of 10 chance for the other person is still a very significant probability. And so you're going to see a lot of this misclassification where people look at it binary. You know what I mean? Like, oh, you know, as far as marketing is concerned, like, oh, they're going to buy, they're not going to buy. No, it's just a little bit more likely. There's something in machine learning called LIFT as well, right? Where you have, well, you know, I'm not even going to go there because it gets into the technology. But what I wanted to talk about was this idea of having an AI first strategy. I read that right in this article. I don't know how I feel about that because it's like, if that's what your business is all about, unless your like business is making, building models like academia, research and development, you know, building a foundational model, right? So it's AI first because that's your actual product. But if it's not, and for most people it isn't, what in the world is an AI first strategy? Shouldn't your strategy be like solving problems first strategy or generating revenue strategy? And then if AI is the right tool to do a thing, then you use AI. There are a lot of times when we have this idea, like I'm going to apply this model, I'm going to do this thing, when it could have been solved with a simple, some relatively simple software development. Or do you understand what I'm trying to say? It's like,
oh, yeah. I mean, this has been a trend. Yeah, in a different way, this has been a trend in our industry for a long time where people hear about a trend, right? A new technology that sounds really cool. They know on the surface level that it can solve problems for them, but they're not sure what the problems are. So they're like, oh, we're going to be a cloud first strategy. We're going to be an AI first strategy. It's like, well, right. If you don't identify what the business problem is that you're trying to solve, doing it in the cloud or doing it with AI is probably set up for failure, right? What you really got to do is take a step back and be like, what are the business problems that we're trying to solve? And, you know, then find a solution that solves that problem, right?
Yeah. And these are legitimate projects, and ML has broad industry-wide, multiple industry, like a cross-industry application, because we are talking about math. My concern is misrepresenting the ability of predictive performance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that's going to be a problem that, you know, what can a model truly achieve? And if you do a little bit better than flipping a coin, that's from a technical perspective, good. Like if you're an ML ops person, right? Like that's a great success because you beat out flipping a coin, right? You're technically more effective.
Yeah. But how much money did you spend to beat out flipping a coin? It's like you and I could flip a coin
right.
for free.
Well, that's what I mean.
We don't spend billions of dollars.
Like, what's
to do that?
The business value? So remember whenever you start, and I'm speaking to myself, I'm speaking to you, I'm speaking to our audience, whenever you're thinking about AI initiatives or hearing people talk about it, you do need to tie it back to that. Like, what is the actual goal here? And is AI necessary to solve it? And if so, what is the cost to get there? Whether it's figuring out your data pipeline, or in our industry, your telemetry pipelines, and then, you know, is the result of a predictive model significant enough that it's worth the investment? Accurate enough? And then accuracy means something different in like the technical world than it does in like the business world. So making sure we're all on the same page. At the same time, though, this is so interesting to me and very, very cool to see tapping into AI's actual potential, right? Like this article said. But, you know, we're talking about early stages in the IT world and in the telecom world. And so we're going to start fleshing some of these things out. We've been talking about partnerships this entire podcast today. So we're going to see some of those flesh out, how we solve some of these data problems. That's what a lot of these partnerships are, by the way. I mean, it's like, how do we get the data? Well, let's partner with them because they have data. Well, we need that data. Let's partner with them. Well, we need these chips to run this in this cloud. So let's partner with them. And all of a sudden you have a solution through partnerships. So really interesting stuff. I'm really excited personally because this has been a big part of my life for the past few years.
Yeah. And I mean, some snark and cynicism aside, I do think as an industry, once we figure out some of these tangible use cases and tangible applications for AI, we're going to solve problems that have been plaguing us as an industry for a long time.
Yeah.
And so I think I've probably said on the podcast before, like, I firmly believe that AI is going to be like the next internet in the way that it changes our society and how we do things. Now, that being said, there's going to be a lot of like hype. There's going to be a lot of things that people don't fully understand the technology or getting people excited about things that AI can't actually do, either because the data's not there, the data's not clean, like you're highlighting there, Phil. But that doesn't mean that it's not real, that it doesn't exist, that there aren't real, you know, tangible solutions to it. We just have to, as engineers, think through like what's real and what's hype, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I absolutely agree with you. This is very real technology. We can point to specific, you know, algorithms. There's real technology. But in order to do this effectively over the long term and solve these problems, we are talking about upskilling entire staff, you know, bringing on ML ops engineers or data scientists where you never had a data scientist before, or a team of data scientists, basically skilled AI talent to do this into perpetuity, because you are talking about having to maintain these data pipelines and these architectures. And we're only now talking about the potential cybersecurity risks and the governance frameworks, whether it's regulated or not regulated. We're only starting to talk about that. So the applications are awesome, but we are such at the early stages. And I think it's fantastic. I don't know about you, Justin, but I was getting bored talking about BGP, right? You know, so I can talk
about BGP all day long, but I take your point. Yeah.
I
I think I was thinking as you were going through your statement about like political and stats and which candidate's going to win. I think a lot of that confusion comes from people who, you know, maybe never studied statistics or the basics and don't understand sample size and whether or not the sample size is representative of the whole. And so, to your point, having at least a basic working knowledge of statistics and how some of these algorithms work and which algorithms are a good application to certain problems is going to be really key to the successful outcome of a lot of these initiatives, right?
Yeah, I agree, but not for most people. I think most, even technical leaders, can get away with a foundational understanding what to ask, what's important. And then high-level architecture stuff, kind of like a really good VP of engineering doesn't necessarily need to know the syntax of how to configure VTEPs for their VXLAN environment. They just need to know these things exist and like how they work together. So I think, you know, business leaders, even technical leaders, but business leaders, understanding how to spot AI initiatives, where it's applicable, what the considerations are in getting there, I think that's going to be like the main skill sets. And not necessarily like, which algorithm do I apply here? Which model do we use? Do we use, you know, cosine similarity, or do we clustering? Like, whatever, you know, we have engineers that can do that. So I think that's going to be where we see the real meaningful benefits and results of applying AI to our industry.
Yeah.
And I think that's sorely lacking, by the way.
Yeah.
And you and me, I'm speaking for you, I'm sorry. You and I included tend to be more nerdy and focus on a lot of the technical stuff, which I love. But if you got into the weeds, statistical analysis is just scratching the surface. You need to get deep into like linear algebra and all these things where it's, you know, it's much more advanced. So, and good luck with that.
All right, moving on. Final article for today from the Associated Press on March 11th. Musk's Starlink and Bharti Airtel, who's a big mobile carrier in India, sign a deal to explore bringing satellite internet to India. So we've covered a number of similar articles like this on the podcast before, but Starlink is going out and signing a lot of contracts with a lot of the carriers around the globe to allow customers to roam from terrestrial 5G mobile networks to Starlink's satellite internet. This article didn't highlight it, but some of the previous ones we've covered, they're usually starting with text messaging. I think a lot of the people who were based in the U.S. saw the NFL Super Bowl commercial where the T-Mobile partnership was announced, and the use case there in the commercial was someone who's out hiking in the woods and needs to be able to get a text out to a loved one to let them know they're okay or share pictures of the beautiful scenery. So presumably this is something similar to that, where subscribers can send text messages through Starlink when they don't have a cell phone signal through a normal radio tower. But yeah, just continuing to see more evolution of this, more partnerships announced, signing Starlink with the various mobile carriers around the globe. And of course, this is a huge one, being in that how big of a country India is and how many mobile subscribers are in India.
I don't know if you mentioned it, but I read here that over 40% of India's population, their 1.4 billion people population, does not have internet access, especially in remote regions, right? Mountainous regions. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a very large country, subcontinent. So this is a big deal. And I'm surprised this didn't happen sooner, because that is such an important market. So yeah, very, very interesting.
Yeah, my bias is I always think of India as like the cities. But yeah, to your point, there's a lot of rural areas in India, just like a lot of other countries. And yeah, a lot of those people are underserved with internet or don't even have access to it in 2025, which is something we kind of take for granted in where we live, Phil.
Yeah, that's a good point. There are security concerns, there's government approval, so this is not a quick win for Starlink, or for India for that matter. So there's going to be a process to go through. And, you know, there are going to be local telecoms that oppose this as well, because they're going to see potential loss of revenue and a subscriber base. And so moving on to upcoming events, we have the Philadelphia Networking User Group on March 19th. I don't know if that's in Philadelphia proper. I think it's outside Philly. Well, you could check the USNUA website, usnua.com. Click on Groups and Events and look up the Philadelphia NUG there and see the town if it's near you. We have Networking Field Day 37, March 19 and 20 out in Silicon Valley, and also live stream. So make sure you check out the live stream. Some really interesting vendors are going to be presenting. I've been checking them out. NVIDIA GTC AI Conference, March 17 through 21. I don't have it in front of me, but I believe that's also in the Bay Area, San Jose. Justin, you aware?
I'm not sure. Yep. I have to go look. Yeah.
Yep. I see it here. DCD Connect. So that's data center focused in New York City, March 24 and 25. I will be at that one. In fact, Justin, I'm going to be on a panel discussing or debating InfiniBand and Ethernet, our beloved technologies.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, so that'll be an interesting one.
That'll be good.
And last but not least, we have the Connecticut NUG, Connecticut Networking User Group, March 27. So make sure to check that out on the USNUA website if that's near you for time and exact location. So with that, those are the headlines for today. See you next time.